Hi there, and welcome to Business Beyond Borders, where we unlock the secrets of international success. I'm Cynthia Dearen, and today I'm chatting to my colleague, Gary Garner, about Brexit. Gary.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you going? Good to see you again.
My voice is in an absolute state today.
That's all right. We'll get through it. Don't worry.
Now, things are getting weirder by the day in Brexit land. Would you agree?
I would say that, yes.
So we might not hash through all the detail of what's gone on since we, you know, turned away from the TV for 30 seconds.
Yes.
Because it's pretty much guaranteed that we've missed the latest. But I did want to ask you about David Cameron's memoir, which came out over the weekend. What's it about, and how do you think it plays into what's going on with Brexit at the moment?
Yeah, well, most politicians, they come up with their memoir at some point, and it's their sort of attempt at claiming their legacy and just taking their position in history, so to speak. And I guess David Cameron does get a lot of the blame for what happened with all this this Brexit issue. But I mean, as he said, the psychodrama in the Tory party has been going on for 30 or 40 years now. And when I was a student at university, it was starting then. But certainly, he is quite critical of the attitudes of Johnson and Gove in how they took the Brexit, the Leave campaign forward, particularly some of the claims they made and some of their behaviours of other ministers within his government. Now, I can understand why that would be the case, but clearly it does go to the bottom of the Tory party's problem. And I think, I haven't read the memoir yet, I've just been reading the Sunday Times in London, but certainly, the politics of Brexit is a party political issue. I don't think it's a crisis of Parliament, because if you look at British Parliament, it's doing what parliaments do when there's no majority government in control.
Yeah.
In some respects, the unwritten constitution seems to be working, although there could be risks given some of the things that some of the politicians are doing. So nonetheless, it's been a very interesting time. I did political science at university, and I've never had the opportunity to see a laboratory experiment in constitutional politics. So it's fascinating stuff. But Cameron really is putting his legacy in place. He's highly critical of the current government and members of that government. His timing, it can't be an accident that he's doing it now, just before the party conference season in the UK. And we're weeks away from possibly leaving the EU. So the timing is interesting. I'm not entirely sure how much notice people will take of him, but you know, there's a few scores being settled as I see it.
Quick question for you on Boris Johnson. There are people who think that he essentially manufactured Brexit from start to finish as a way to get himself the top job. What do you think of that as an argument?
Well, I think there's something in that. I mean, he's clearly, like all politicians want to have power, so let's not criticise him for that. He has a bit of a track record of being liberal or illiberal with the truth, perhaps. So I think he has a track record in people's minds. So I think that's a problem for him at the moment. And I think part of the trouble he's having in Parliament is that no one believes or trusts in him. So the Parliament's reacted quite strongly against his prorogation of Parliament and other things he's been doing and talking about. So it doesn't go down very well. I think, though, he didn't develop Brexit. He took an opportunity there because UKIP, I mean, Nigel Farage has been the advocate for independence of Britain from Europe for the last 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where it's come from in many respects. That party and now the Brexit party certainly feeds into the neurosis that exists within the Tory party. There's a small band of ERG that are absolutely want to get out of Europe regardless. So they should be in the Brexit party in that sense. So this has been going on for 30 odd years, ever since Margaret Thatcher, her and other prime ministers have all been affected by the whole Eurosceptics situation. Now, I think that's going to continue for a while, and whatever happens, it's going to be a problem for British politics. So what we're now seeing is the collapse of the party political system, I believe, in the UK. Both major parties are finding it difficult to deal with Brexit. There's divisions all over the place. What we're now seeing is that the division in the UK is not between right and left, but between Brexit and Remain. And we've now seen the Liberal Democrats come out very strongly in favour of a Remain strategy. They would revoke Article 50. So they can do that because they probably won't get into government. But nonetheless, there's a very clear choice now between a Liberal Democratic strongly Remain argument and a Brexit party strongly get out of Europe element. And the other parties are trying to fit in between. And that's the challenge that Johnson will have, I believe.
Looking at the range of issues that are on the table, do you think that the Northern Ireland backstop is still the biggest obstacle to actually getting a deal? And before you answer that, I might actually just get you to go back and explain for people who are not clear on what it is, how that backstop could work.
Yeah. Well, the actual history of Ireland and England in particular, but the United Kingdom, has been a colourful one for several centuries now. So it's been interesting to see Ireland popping up in British history every now and again. The late 19th century, Home Rule almost took place, but then there was a break in the Parliament over that. The backstop really is trying to safeguard the agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland back in, what, 97, I think, or thereabouts. It was a very important move on the part of all parties to come to an agreement that they would not fight each other, they would work together, there'd be a common recognition of the rights of all parties in Parliament. The Unionists and the Sinn Féin were working together. There was an agreement between Southern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland and the British government to jointly administer Ireland. So it's a very important agreement. It's a very complex one. I don't have all the details, but clearly it's fundamental to bringing peace to Ireland. You know, as somebody who worked in London in the 70s and 80s, it was a fairly hairy place sometimes with the odd bomb going off, but clearly everyone benefited from that. It was made easy because, in fact, both countries, the Republic of Ireland and the UK, joined the EU at about the same time. So we had a common framework of border governance, say, within the European context. There was peace on Ireland through the peace agreement. Now, by leaving the EU, Britain is departing from the Republic of Ireland, because although Ireland's a separate country and sovereign country, they're very close economically and politically and even socially in some respects. So what we've now got is the risk that if you separate from Europe, then naturally there's a customs border appears on what is the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. That has to be protected. Now, how do you do that? Because if you've separated from EU, then naturally new tariffs will come into place and these have to be collected and all that paraphernalia of customs control. So that's one thing. It's a technical issue in one level, but in terms of the way the Irish politics works, to have a border set up with even notional customs control, never mind having any military involvement, is going to be anathema to many people living certainly at the border, and for people of Republican and or Unionist persuasion. The Unionists don't want to become part of the Republic, so they're very keenly clinging to the UK as part of their right, which they are. Many Republicans will be more than happy for the two provinces or one country and a province to merge. So that's the complexity. So how do you navigate this? Mm. The British government hasn't been too clever. They've been talking about alternative arrangements and technologies that nobody's actually specified what they are. So it is at the core, really, of getting an agreement. What upsets the fanatics, as I would call them, in the ERG, is that by having this relationship around the border, by trying to safeguard the agreement, 1990s agreement, they end up effectively remaining part of the European Union. So yeah. This group has been against that. They rebelled against Theresa May throughout the last several months. And now we have sort of Remainers doing the same. So it really is at the core of what is going to be have to be the final arrangements between Europe and Britain. Mm. It is ironic in a way that it is an Irish issue that is again affecting a constitutional outcome in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
So from your point of view, when you look at Britain now and the people you're dealing with, SMEs from Australia, do you still see an opportunity for SMEs out of Australia and the UK?
Yes, I do. I think for companies that haven't already launched there, some are obviously a little bit hesitant because they look at what's going on with Brexit and they do wonder how things will be going forward. But for many others, they look at the UK and they say, well, we're not European, we're Australian. And so in some ways, we are not affected very much by the current circumstances. Mm. And in fact, if there is going to be an impact on us, it will be one that we benefit from rather than a negative one. Mm, okay. So, for example, if you're a European company currently headquartered in the UK and Brexit takes place, Boris Johnson has said, if we have no deal Brexit, nobody who is from Europe will be guaranteed to be able to remain in the UK. They'll essentially have to reapply for their right to live in the UK. Now, if that goes ahead and people are not allowed to remain, who is going to fill those thousands of jobs that will suddenly become available? Because at the moment, London in particular is hugely reliant on foreign labour to make everything work.
Yes.
So there could be an immediate opportunity for anybody from that former Commonwealth Empire to really jump in and take up some of those spots that can become available.
Yeah.
Australian companies will be in a great position to capitalise on that because we already have such a close and such a special relationship with the United Kingdom. If you look at, and so that's kind of on the human movement side and the services side. If you look at the product side, European companies have obviously benefited enormously over the duration of the customs union in sectors like dairy.
Yeah.
And so French and Italian companies have been able to sell their cheese, their milk, their yogurt very, very inexpensively into the UK market and to make the most of that. If a no-deal Brexit happens, or if we have an arrangement where the customs union is broken up, suddenly all those UK tariffs are suddenly going to apply to European product again, but they may well not apply to Australian and New Zealand product, especially if we see a favourable trade deal struck with Australia and New Zealand and the UK.
Yeah.
And so Australian and New Zealand, let's say, for example, dairy product might actually be in a better position than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you there, because I think, in fact, with the FTAs, Britain needs an FTA to make it all work.
Yeah.
And therefore, that puts an advantage, I believe, in countries like Australia, with historical connections, you say, I think they're going to be able to do a good deal for Australia with the UK.
So, I mean, I think short term, it's problematic because people feel uncertain.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that people have delayed investing in the UK because of the uncertainty and people not wanting to take too much of a gamble, with their resources.
Yeah.
But I think longer term, it's likely that countries like Australia and New Zealand stand to benefit.
Yeah, I agree. And I think because of the SMEs are smaller businesses, they're not really going to take the whole of Europe on in one go. And the Anglo-sphere relationship, so to speak, is there to be built upon. And I think it's still a big market. It's a $3 trillion almost market, 65 million people. There's a lot to happen, a lot to be done in that market. So I agree with you. It's only if you're a big company that you actually might think, well, if we want to go into Europe, then the UK may not be the best place to go to.
I suppose you might question whether you would set up a European base in London if a no-deal Brexit came to pass. That would obviously make things a lot trickier than previously. So if you're in financial services, for example, all the passporting of services, which is currently in place, which means that you can bypass the financial rules and operate from London into other countries. If that arrangement goes away, it obviously becomes a lot harder to get things done.
Mm.
But, as you say, if people just want to start in the UK market, that's pretty feasible.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this whole question, I mean, that's why a no deal is really the worst deal that Britain can have, despite what Theresa May said, because I think you could still be based. If we have the withdrawal agreement, and it's just a withdrawal agreement, it's not an agreement to do anything else, you've still got a couple of years to agree a trade agreement. Now, it shouldn't be too difficult, given that Britain is part of the EU, to just disassociate itself, but also maintain the standards. So they'll be there already. So I think you're right. I mean, it would be possible to still consider the UK as a base. But certainly for an SME looking for a growth market, the UK probably still is one available to them.
Look, I'd say so. And for the companies that I work with, many of them still plan to go to the UK and really don't have any plans to particularly put things on hold.
No.
They're going ahead as though it's business as usual.
Although in the European context, there are still, I mean, there's Malta, Cyprus, and Ireland, Southern Ireland, that have sort of, they're English speaking clearly, have common law bases. They're still good bases for services.
Yes.
And as I said in my blog the other day, that the Netherlands is probably a good base because they speak excellent English in the Netherlands. It's almost embarrassing to go there and speak English. But there are options for those who want to go into the European theatre.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen & Associates website, dearenassociates.com.
One more question for you. I thought in terms of Brexit, obviously a very much a British thing, and it has implications for the UK. And I think analysis has to consider the politics and the situation before an investment. But do you see a broader global issue around the sort of fundamentals that have driven the Brexit debate or outcome?
I think it's interesting. I think politically speaking, we are seeing a move towards regionalism. Mm. The 1990s was kind of the high point of globalization.
Yeah.
In some people's minds, you know, Francis Fukuyama, the end of history, when everybody thought, okay, all the national divides have gone away, all the barriers have come down. I think we've really come back somewhat from that. And so there is a lot more nationalism around. There's a lot more protectionism around than there was 20 years ago. So I think politically, yeah, you probably are seeing some of the fundamentals that have driven Brexit in different theatres around the world. But I think there is a countervailing force on the economic front.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that there are some mega trends which are currently shaping the global economy and the international business landscape that kind of offset that protectionism. What are they? Well, I see three major ones. One is that technology has shrunk the world. And what I mean by that is that the technology that we have available to us now means that we can do things that we couldn't even contemplate a decade ago.
Yeah.
You know, we can hire our house out to a complete stranger on Airbnb. You and I can sit here and put out this podcast to people anywhere in the world.
Yes.
We can sell goods and services to places we basically almost never heard of.
Yeah.
So that's a massive change. And that ability to reach out across the world really offsets some of that protectionism and regionalism. The second trend is global value chains. And a global value chain, for those who don't know, is a supply chain in the creation of a product or service where each component part is made in a different place.
Yeah.
So once upon a time, it was the norm that you'd make and assemble all parts of a product in one country. So if you had a car, all the bits would be made in Australia and the thing would be assembled in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the norm for the component parts to come from three or four places and for the product to be perhaps assembled in a fifth place. And what that means is that that explosion in global supply chains has really boosted industry trade and also international trade. So again, it sort of militates against protectionism because you rely as a manufacturer of a good or of a service on inputs from all around the world.
Yeah, and I mean, there are parallels, as we discussed previously, on the mid-19th century to late 19th century world scene when globalization, that's the last main globalization really prior to the First World War, and then came from the UK through the Corn Laws in the mid 19th century. But as we went into more competitive environments, the global economies expanded, particularly through the empires. New powers rose, like Germany, for example, United States, even India in that sense, that it affected the sort of sense of normalization that the world had at that time. I wonder whether we have the same thing now, where we've got used to the global supply chains, yet the politics of power, you know, particularly rising China, is not just about its economy, it's about its view of itself in the world and how it should be respected as a world power and with all that goes with that. And
yes.
So that, as we see in the United States, there's a sort of conflict going on about trade. So it goes beyond the economic, but into the political. And I wonder if that's a big change.
Well, look, I think they bleed into one another, and it's hard to completely separate politics and economics.
Yes, I think
because
so.
People tend to use them to play one another off. But the question is, can people be pragmatic enough to keep the trade side of things running despite their political disagreements?
Yeah.
And I think it'd be great if people could, because people stand to benefit from that far more on the whole than if you put the barriers back up and you go back to a protectionist mindset.
Yeah, I think you're right. So look, here we are in the middle of September. We're sort of 6 weeks away from Brexit date. What's your gut feeling about what's going to happen? You won't know for sure because no one can know the future, but where would you put money now if you were going to do it?
You know, I hesitate to take out the crystal ball because I think nobody can actually know the future. I wouldn't be surprised if it wound up in either a no deal or if the UK actually didn't leave the European Union at all.
Yeah, that's an interesting view because a lot of people are saying now that there's negotiations going on and Europe does have a track record, right? Last minute coming to terms with the adversary, so to speak. So that might happen. But I think that's quite possible. And it does depend on the timing of any election that's going to have to happen in the next few months.
And look, I think Europe doesn't feel as though they need to agree to a lot of the things that the UK has asked for, because essentially it's quite possible that the UK is going to be worse off under any arrangement than the EU is just because they're one party, the EU are many parties. But I think we'll really just have to wait and see.
Yeah, for the EU, it's challenging because the one thing the UK did do for the EU was it gave it that sort of free market balance. In fact, for the free market, the open market, the single market, came out of Margaret Thatcher. They pushed for that in those good glorious days. So you wonder exactly how they're going to be affected with Germany also having a recession due to its exposure to China. So they won't be happy about it. But I think you're right. On balance, the European project's more important to them than you could keep Britain happy.
And look, at the end of the day, the problem is really the UK's, because as the EU has said, when Britain can come back and tell us what it actually wants, we'll agree something with them. But at the moment, the UK is such a divided house that they don't seem to be able to come up with any agreement on what should actually happen.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe we should revisit this in, say, mid-November, in 2 months' time. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, let's do that.
Gary, thanks for having you on the show.
Cheers, bye.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen & Associates website, dearenassociates.com. Our consulting services, which include market research and modelling, cross-cultural consulting, and strategic business connections, deliver deep insights and create value for larger companies looking to scale internationally. If you're from a smaller organisation that wants to expand its global footprint, take a look at our International Business Accelerator program, which my team and I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of going global. The program helps business owners to build a great strategy without having to reinvent the wheel. It creates the momentum to put the strategy into play, and it helps them to generate or raise the funds that they need to get an international expansion off the ground. We built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and wondering where to start. It's structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital so that you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. Check it out at dearenassociates.com.